Christianity requires that you be of sober mind. That's why Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, to gird up the loins of your mind. What does a sober man look like? A sober man is a man who's self-controlled. He's rational. He has disciplined his mind. He calculates himself. He doesn't just go about his day hastily without any kind of thought about it. He doesn't just go with the crowd. He doesn't just subscribe to the latest philosophy of the day. Instead, the sober man, the truly sober man, as far as Peter's concerned, as far as the Holy Spirit is concerned, is the man who digs carefully into the Scriptures. What he does is he considers the long-term consequences of his decisions rather than the short-term pleasures. He's concerned about eternity, and he labors over decisions because holiness always requires hard work. I want you to think, in contrast to the lifestyle of sinning, it doesn't take much mental capacity to sin. You've never had to use your brain very much in order to sin. Isn't that what we ourselves say? If someone says, "Why did you do this bad thing?" Whatever it was, what is often our first response? "I wasn't thinking." Isn't that what we say? That's how we excuse our actions. "I wasn't thinking." And isn't there truth to that? Because sin doesn't require much thought. We can be overcome by evil simply by dropping all restraints and letting our lusts take over. Isn't that where sin comes from? We create sin in James chapter 1 when desire gives birth. Our desire is interwoven with the lusts, and everyone's lusts are a little bit different. We just have to act on those lusts, though. We stop thinking about our actions. And that's why perhaps Peter says in verse 14, the next verse, right after talking about put on the gird up the loins of your mind, he talks about how we fulfill our lusts in our ignorance. Verse 14. That might be why traditions can often be very dangerous. Well, why is it that traditions can be dangerous? Well, because traditions don't really require any thinking. We do things because that's how we've always done it. And how we've always done it becomes the standard, the gold standard, rather than constantly being sober-minded enough to compare everything that we do in light with Scripture. And so that's why Peter says in verse 18, he talks about our aimless conduct received by our traditions. That's why traditions can often be dangerous, because we stop thinking. And we're inconvenienced if we have to think about something, doing something outside of the box. We have to be discerning, though, because we have to remember that a teacup of holiness requires much more energy than an ocean of evil. The Christian must be in control of himself in all circumstances. He must have the spiritual foresight to take spiritual matters seriously. He must be able to make sound decisions in matters of judgment in view of eternal consequences. Now, I don't know of a single person in this church who's an active alcoholic. I don't know of a single person in this church who drinks socially on the weekends. I don't know of a single person in this church who keeps a beer in his fridge to drink right after he's been cutting the grass. So I'm not addressing any of these things, but I do know that from time to time what we need to do is we need to talk about alcohol in order to keep our minds clear on the subject. Alcohol is talked about in the Bible. The principles, at least, are. And if we're going to talk about the whole council, then we have to talk about this subject. This week, I was talking to a fellow gospel preacher in a different state, and one of the members of his congregation had to be sentenced to some sort of crime. It was a small matter. I didn't ask for details. But the preacher, he was there in the county courthouse, and he had to sit through a bunch of other cases before it was the member's turn. Evidently, he had to sit through 21 cases before it was time for the member to be sentenced. And he remarked to me, he just mentioned it in a conversation, that 20 of the 21 cases involved alcohol. That was very interesting. 20 of the 21. You know about the 21st one? It involved meth. So all of them involve some sort of mind-altering substance. You know, you would have to be pretty dishonest to not believe that an incredible chunk of the world's problems would go away if there was no such thing as intoxicating drink. Wouldn't this world be a better place? It would be a better place, would it not? I want you to consider just for a moment some of the Bible tragedies that we read about, just the stories that involve alcohol. You think about Noah, for example. In Genesis chapter 9, you find right after the flood is over, he's gotten off the boat, he decides to plant a vineyard. He harvested the juice. And I don't know if in this point in human history they had a clear concept of how to ferment juice. I don't know. But anyway, what he does is he drinks juice that has been fermented, that has been cultivated in such a way that there is now alcohol within the wine, within the fruit of the vine. And he's foolish for drinking it because of what it does to him. The text goes on to say he lays uncovered in his tent, and his son takes advantage of his father in some way. We're not going to read that text, and there's a bunch of insinuation there that discusses about how some other things went on, but we don't have time to go there. But it was a mess. Now, I just want you to appreciate the regrets that he had from this tragedy. The family was hurt. His reputation was blemished. Because now, for thousands of years, we've talked about this mistake that Noah made by drinking this alcoholic beverage. You think about Lot in Genesis chapter 19. His daughters convinced him to drink alcoholic beverage, some sort of drink, and it made him drunk. And over the next two nights, they both slept with their father in order to become pregnant. Now, by drinking this alcohol, what Lot did is he abdicated his role as the head of his family. And the result was to create pain that would last for generations and generations, and it would affect thousands of people because of what he did that night, those two nights, because of the alcohol that he drank. Think about Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 36. His wife comes to him trying to tell him about the crisis that had been averted. But when she came to him, he was throwing a party, a celebration, and he was heavily intoxicated, so much so that he was kind of mean, and it created this barrier between him and his wife, and she couldn't talk to him until the next day. And when she told him what she had to do the next day, of course, that's when he had a stroke. That's what the Hebrew seems to suggest, and he died soon after. But what we see in this story of Nabal is that the alcohol created with him this mean disposition, and it put a barrier between him and his wife, and he died a miserable man as a result. You have Ahasuerus in Esther chapter 1. He was the king over all the land from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, and he decided to throw a week-long party. Well, it was to cap off a 180-day party celebrating his greatness. And for the week-long party, there was all kinds of wine and alcohol there. And on the last day, he was heavily intoxicated. And so at that moment, that's when he asked his wife Vashti to stand before the people so that they could gawk at her, because the text says she was very beautiful. Of course, she was very embarrassed by this and refused. And in his anger, in his drunken state, he humiliated her by sending a memo around the entire kingdom, bringing her to shame. It's because he indulged in this alcohol that his wife was ashamed of him, and he made public statements about her that ruined their marriage. We have Belshazzar, Daniel chapter 5, the last king of Babylon. He made a great feast for the elites of his country, and he was drunk, and in his drunken state, he brought in the holy items from the temple of the Jews that had been ransacked, and they stole from the Jews, and they, in the party, they made a mockery of the holy gold and silver items. And in so doing, that's when the handwriting on the wall happened. The alcohol in his system, however, caused him to do something that was very sacrilegious and really out of character for even him to do. The alcohol is why he did it. You think about Herod in Mark chapter 6. You have Herod's birthday party, and I assume there was alcohol there because everything that happened is just indicative that there was alcohol there. That's when he had that big party, that big celebration, and his daughter comes in and dances before all the elites. It's this lustful event. It's awful. And then he promises to give her any wish up to half of her kingdom. And you recall what happened. That's when she asks for John's head to be severed from his body. Why does the Bible condemn intoxication? Why is it that Paul says, do not be getting drunk? In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18. The answer is because it destroys our sober-mindedness. It destroys our ability to think clearly. And so, for this reason, the Bible condemns even, quote-unquote, moderate drinking. Because moderate drinking, quote-unquote, as most people practice it today in America, scientifically speaking, still involves intoxication. So what I want to do, just for the rest of our day, is I want to look at the top six arguments in favor of a Christian consuming alcoholic beverage. Just look at the top six, statements or misconceptions about this and just respond to them, and then the lesson will be yours. Here's the first, perhaps the most common. What you hear people saying is, well, Jesus turned water into wine, so Jesus must endorse drinking socially. He must be okay with that. I think this is a very interesting argument, and I wanted to spend a little bit of time answering this. Going into this, we need to remember that there's no Greek word for alcohol. You'll search in the Bible all day long, and you won't find a word specifically that's used all the time in reference to alcohol. Because after all, the chemical compound known as alcohol wasn't discovered until the 8th or 9th century. What you do read about in the Bible, specifically the New Testament, is the word wine. And the word wine is from a Greek word, oinos. Now, oinos is just a general word. It just means literally must of the grape. Must is a Latin word for young wine. But oinos just means some sort of produce, some sort of juice from the grape. That's all it means. It's a generic word, and it can refer to any kind of juice from the vine. It can refer to either fresh juice from the vine or stale juice that has not really been fermented properly. It's just old. Or it can refer to juice that has been specifically tampered with to produce an intoxicating effect. And so it's a general word, and you must always look at the context to see what it's referring to. So just because you read the word wine in the Bible doesn't mean it's referring specifically to alcoholic wine. Now that's interesting because today, in 21st century America, the word wine in our modern vernacular almost always refers to an alcoholic beverage, but that's not true in the Bible. It's just a translation of the word oinos. Now, the oinos in John chapter 2. Now, by the way, we read about Jesus turning the water into wine in John 2. And the first 11 verses of that chapter are about this story. Now, when we read about the oinos in John 2, it's without a doubt, just the context, it's without a doubt that that wine is in reference to the common table beverage of Palestine. And in the ancient world, including Palestine, oinos, that wine, generic wine, was always mixed liberally with water. It was most unlikely that such a diluted drink, if you mixed it with water the way they mixed it with water, would make anyone drunk. Children drank this wine, for example. For the Passover, the Talmud speaks of mixing wine with three parts water. One part wine, 3 point water. Homer in the Odyssey speaks of diluting it 20 to 1. In Pliny, in his Natural History, he describes mixing in the ancient world the water 8 to 1 and 2 to 1 for medicinal purposes. But just for drinking it as a beverage, you would mix it with the water. In Jesus' day, it was considered intemperate to drink wine that was not diluted with water. Now, if you read John chapter 2, if you just read the text as it naturally flows, I keep reading John 2, and I can't find any indication that that oinos was specifically alcoholic. There's only a distinction between fresh, quality oinos and less quality oinos. Now, notice in the text that by the time they had ran out of the wine, the people had, quote-unquote, drunk freely. And that's a key phrase right there. They had been drinking that freely. They were well imbibed with that wine that they had been drinking that whole time. And then they ran out. And so Jesus produced more wine, the fresh stuff. Now, think about that. If that had been alcoholic wine that they had been drinking freely, they would be fairly intoxicated, or at least well on their way, if they had been drinking freely. And then put yourself in the shoes of Jesus. Would Jesus... Now, bear in mind, Jesus is the same God who said in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 31, "Do not look at the wine when it sparkles in the cup and it goes down smoothly." Don't even look at it. Don't look at the alcoholic stuff. Don't take part in it. That same God, doesn't it seem a little bit contradictory if the same God that said that in Proverbs 22:31 would then turn around and create more alcoholic wine for people who had already been, quote-unquote, drinking freely? It seems awfully inconsistent for him to do that. Bear in mind that Jesus made 150 gallons of this wine, encouraging them to drink more of it. Seems awfully inconsistent. The context, however, is that this was just the common table beverage of ancient Palestine, and it was common to dilute that with water, even if it was somewhat alcoholic. Here's the second thing. Number two, it's okay to drink in moderation, so long as you don't get drunk. Now, this is, of course, a very common argument. It ties first place with the first argument that we just looked at. Now, we have to remember that to the world, as well as many mainstream denominations within Christendom, there is a social stigma against getting drunk, but not really against drinking socially or drinking, quote-unquote, moderately. And that's, of course, the politically correct position to take. The politically correct position to take is that, well, you can drink a little bit as long as you don't get drunk, as long as you know your limits. And, of course, this is where you're going to find a lot of gospel preachers among our own people. This is the same position they're going to take. Now, let's assume for a moment that it is possible to drink moderately without getting drunk. I'm not saying it is. Let's just assume, just for the sake of our conversation, just for a moment, let's assume that it's possible to drink moderately without getting drunk. I want you to turn your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12. This is what the Apostle Paul writes. He says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything." I want you to look at that statement phrase by phrase with me. He starts off by saying, "All things are lawful." What does he mean by that? Well, what he's saying is that God has formed all things in this world with some sort of legitimate use. But, he's saying, I need to avoid things that are going to be counterproductive for my Christian walk. God did create alcohol. He did create the chemical compound alcohol. And what legitimate use is there for alcohol? Well, there's a couple of things I can think of. You have the medicinal use. Remember, Paul told Timothy to take a little wine for a stomach sick. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But here's Paul telling Timothy to take a little wine for a medicinal purpose. The same is found in Proverbs chapter 31, verse 6. It's for those who are perishing. That would apply to any kind of drug that's a narcotic that's designed to alleviate the pain in some way. Another legitimate use for alcohol, perhaps, is using it as some sort of flavoring in some circumstances. You think about vanilla extract. Every woman in this room has used vanilla extract. If you ever looked at the ingredients, it's 50% alcohol. Straight up alcohol. But why is it there? Well, because it's there for flavoring purposes. Now hold that thought. Paul says, all things are lawful. Well, God created alcohol because there are some legitimate uses for it. But then Paul says, not all things are helpful. Your version might use the word expedient. Things which some people argue are not, quote unquote, sinful in and of themselves, but will hinder your work, hinder your walk, hinder your service to the Lord in an obvious way. We know what alcohol does to people. I think about Uriah in 2 Samuel chapter 11, where David, he'd committed fornication with Uriah's wife, and she's pregnant, and he's trying to cover it up. And so he brings Uriah back from the front lines, and he tries to make it look like Uriah, this is Uriah's child. And so he can't get him to visit his house. And so he decides to make Uriah drunk, because he knows that if you make someone drunk, it's a lot easier to convince someone to do what you want them to do if you get them drunk. Now, the question is, will alcohol damage your Christian values? Will alcohol damage your Christian duties? Listen, it will. Alcohol has the power. It is here, right here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It falls under this category. Alcohol is capable of damaging your influence. Try sharing the gospel when you had a glass of beer in your hand. It's hard. Even non-Christians associate the consumption of alcohol as being against non-Christian values. You try to convince someone that you're a Christian, they need to become a Christian with a beer in your hand. It's hard. It's hard. But look back at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. He says, I will not be dominated by anything. In other words, what he's saying is, let me avoid things that rob me of my independent mind. That's what he's saying. And this is going to cover all kinds of categories. Think about smoking. I don't care about eating. I just want to smoke. What does smoking do to us? It's addictive, isn't it? Tobacco usage. Materialism. You reckon there's anyone who claims to be a Christian who's still dominated by materialism? What about laziness? You ever met some lazy people who claim to be Christians? They're dominated by it. You see, we tend to mold God into this form where we can be faithful, yet still keep whatever it is that dominates us dominating us. That's what we want to do. Is there any question that alcohol has an addictive quality to it? Without a doubt, the Bible condemns drunkenness. Just go back to the question. It's okay to drink in moderation so long as you don't get drunk. What they would say is the Bible only condemns drunkenness. Well, let's just play with that now. Is it true that the Bible condemns drunkenness? Well, it's true. It's a sin that will keep you out of heaven. Galatians chapter 5, verse 21 lists drunkenness as the kind of practices that will keep you out of the kingdom of heaven. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 is the same way. And here's my question. How close do you want to get to that line? If it's something that's going to keep you out of heaven, how good with you are you at getting close to that edge? Now, let's go back to the heart of the issue, though. It's true that the Bible does not tell us when we get drunk. The Bible doesn't draw that line for us. It says don't get drunk. It says it'll keep you out of heaven. But the Bible doesn't draw that line for us. And of course, incidentally, I believe that's why a lot of people like to make the claim, oh, the Bible doesn't condemn drinking, just drunkenness. Because it's a slippery relative statement. Who gets to decide when someone's drunk? But unlike the first century, modern science today tells us exactly when someone gets drunk. Remember, in the first century and the centuries before and after, the ancients had no way of measuring alcohol concept. They didn't have a clear idea of the poison known as alcohol. They just knew that it was doing something to their bodies, and they could alter the substance in some way to produce this effect. But they didn't know about the chemical compound as alcohol. But today we do, and we know about drunkenness. Now, drunkenness equals intoxication. When does intoxication occur? Well, intoxication occurs when your liver is unable to metabolize the alcohol in your bloodstream fast enough. That is the scientific definition of intoxication. Your liver is unable to keep up filtering out or metabolizing the alcohol. And so when it's unable to keep up with the metabolism process, the alcohol remains in your bloodstream and it starts depriving the brain of oxygen, and it produces this effect called intoxication. Now, this point, it varies just a little bit between body size, body height, genetics, but only slightly. For the average person, it's pretty clear that that level is about half an ounce of pure alcohol over the course of an hour. Okay, now, pure alcohol, 100% alcohol, half an ounce. If you sipped on that half an ounce of alcohol over the course of an hour, you're right at that line. If you exceed that, you are intoxicated, scientifically speaking. If you're below that, you are not intoxicated. It doesn't affect your sobriety one bit. Now, while alcohol content varies greatly across all the different brands of wine and alcohol, I've got a chart of the alcohol content of every major brand of wine and alcohol. I've run the numbers. You can't drink a 12-ounce glass of any of them the way a normal person drinks it. You know, you're going to drink it within 30 minutes or so. You're in one sitting, you're going to drink it. You can't drink any of them without becoming intoxicated. You can't drink any of them because there's just too much alcohol in it. Now, I know what people say. What they're going to say is, hey, well, Ben, you know, I don't get drunk when I just drink one glass of beer with my buddies. My answer is, no one can know that. No one can feel the level of intoxicating, the level of intoxication in their blood. That's like saying I know my heart rate or my blood pressure or my thyroid level by feeling it. Now, you can kind of get an idea when things start going south. But you don't know the numbers, the actual numbers. It's impossible to know when you begin getting intoxicated without actual data. And further, I want you to think about how the effect of intoxication always lags consumption. So even after you've finished your first beer, you still might not feel drunk because there's still 60% of the alcohol that has yet to be absorbed by your digestive system. Don't we know this when it comes to food? You know this when it comes to food. I know it when it comes to food. We keep eating, and we still feel like we're hungry, and it's not until way later, it's not until like our second or third helping that we realize, whoa, we've overdone it. Because the effects always lag consumption. We might think that we're in control. We might think we're in control. I can handle one glass of beer. And so we have another beer, and before we know it, we really have gone too far. And so here you have a person who's gambling with the edges and doesn't even know where the edge is. Most people are quick to observe that, oh, the Bible doesn't condemn drinking, just drunkenness. Also argue that, why just drink a glass of wine just to relax at the end of the day? But here's the question. What is it about alcohol that's so relaxing? The answer is, alcohol is a depressant. It's a depressant to your body. It relaxes you because it's intoxicating. The part of you that you find relaxing, the part that makes you relax, that's the actual intoxication that's occurring in your body. It's the onset of drunkenness. You know that sin, of course, that those who practice it, it'll keep them out of heaven? That's the onset, that the relaxing feeling that you're feeling. Needless to say, there are other ways to relax without poisoning your body. Did you know that? This is one of the reasons why the Bible says in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1, wine is a mocker. You see, a person who is consuming alcohol is affected in the cerebral cortex, which influences their ability to reason. It influences their ability to make rational decisions, especially in terms of moral judgments. Why would any Christian do that? And this inhibition numbing is exactly what you don't need happening to you when you're trying to drink just one beer and avoid getting drunk, because you start losing the ability to make that decision. Or we could just stick with the Bible, where Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18, don't be getting drunk. Don't begin the process of being intoxicated. Number three, Paul told Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach. Let's read that. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 21. He says, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. Now, by the way, here's a glimpse at the ancient practice of diluting the wine with a lot of water. You would dilute the wine with so much water, by the way, that you would die of water poisoning long before you would get intoxicated. And so here we find a hint. This is an ancient practice. And isn't it interesting that Paul had to specifically tell Timothy to do this, as if Timothy was naturally reluctant to take anything that was going to have an intoxicating effect on him. Now, in this context, it's because the water needed to be cleansed with the oinos, which may have even been a little bit alcoholic. But the reason why you would cleanse the water with oinos is because it acted as a water purifier. And incidentally, we know today that it's a very effective water purifier. Just looking at water samples in ancient Achaia, to make that water where you could drink it and not get sick, you would have to mix it with a little bit of the oinos, because it would purify the water in a very effective way. It's okay. There's a place, as we established already, for alcohol for medicinal purposes. We read in Proverbs chapter 31, verse 4, it's not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to take strong drink, verse 5, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. In other words, here you're in a position of power. You are not to drink alcohol because it impairs your ability to reason. And then he says there is a purpose for it. Verse 6, give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. It's in reference to people who are actually having a medicinal purpose for the wine. Number four, Jesus was a wine bibber. And we read this in Matthew chapter 11, verse 18. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, yet wisdom is justified by their deeds. So the argument goes, well, John didn't drink, and Jesus came drinking, eating and drinking. Thus, Jesus must have been a wine bibber. Now, you look at that, Jesus is simply quoting what was being said about him. And the whole point that the whole reason Matthew includes this in his account is because he's pointing out the fact that none of these accusations were true. Matthew chapter 11 offers no support for the idea that Jesus was actually drinking beverage alcohol. Lastly, or second to last, I want you to see this. Deacons are told not to be addicted to much wine, which implies that moderation is acceptable. I want you to look at this. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8. It says, deacons likewise must be dignified, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. Look at that. It says, not addicted to much wine. So if this is okay, if this authorizes social drinking, is it okay for a deacon to be addicted to a little wine? Is that what we're saying? Because that's what we're making the text say. But that's not what Paul is saying. It's not okay for a deacon to be addicted to any wine, let alone much wine. Your version might use the word given. My version uses the word addicted. Strong's explanation of that Greek word means to hold the mind towards, to pay attention, to apply oneself to. It's the same idea in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 31, where it says, do not get drunk with wine. Don't look at wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. Then verse 32 characterizes this kind of man. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart utter perverse things. Verse 34, you will be like the one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like the one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I didn't feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. That's someone who's given to wine. As soon as they wake up from their drunken stupor, they can't wait to get more. He's saying the deacon can't be like that. He can't be given to wine. The fact that Paul is prohibiting addiction to the drink, it doesn't bear one bit to this idea of moderate drinking. He's just not addressing that. You think about the phrase double-tongued. A deacon is not to be double-tongued. It indicates that the deacon can't be known as a man who's a liar. But does that mean that it's okay for him to lie a little bit? Just less frequently? Or think about Romans chapter 12, verse 1, that says, do not be conformed to the world. Don't be wholeheartedly like the world. Does that mean that it's okay to sin just a little bit? No. And so this idea that the deacon is not to be given to much wine, it doesn't bear one iota onto the topic of moderate drinking. Lastly, they say, well, this is a matter of Christian liberty and thus a Romans 14 issue. Now, Romans 14 is dealing with matters of opinion, matters where it was God that left room for us to decide on our own prerogative the best way to do this or that. But I'm here to tell you that Romans 14 is not talking about matters of sin. It's only talking about matters of opinion. And this issue of drinking beverage alcohol is indeed a matter of sin. And we need to make sure that this is not something we just chalk up to Christian liberty. It is a matter of sin, and we must avoid it. It's a great evil. We all have a choice to make. Are we going to be getting drunk with wine? Are we going to be drinking wine for that buzz, that intoxicating effect, that release, that escape? Or are we going to maintain our sober-mindedness so we can be led, so we can be filled with the Holy Spirit? Paul gives us a choice, and we can't have both. I love talking about the Bible. It's important that we study the Bible, that we talk about these principles so we can know right and wrong. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 14 talks about the man who studies the Bible, who knows the Bible enough that he's able to discern right from wrong, truth from falsehood. And there's many people who sit in pews all across the country today who have been fooled into believing that beverage alcohol is somehow, to some degree, acceptable. But we cannot be fooled. We need to make sure that we are always being able to discern truth from evil. Let's press on. Let's be people who are holy, because holiness requires sobriety. It doesn't require any effort to sin. Maybe you have been under the cruel slave master of sin. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with alcohol, but maybe it's some other sin that's ensnared you. We're here to help one another. We're here to help one another out of sin. We're here to motivate one another to be healthier, to be holier, to be more dedicated to the Lord. And if we're holy before God, if we're trying to keep His law, only then can we really enjoy life to the fullness. Jesus came that we may have life and have it more abundantly. John chapter 10, verse 10. Maybe you're missing out on that abundant life. If you're subject to the invitation in any way, come forward right now as we stand and sing.